In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
Thank you for joining me today, as every week we help you keep an eye on big government. On today's iSpy Radio Show, we'll be talking Second Amendment. It's been said that the Second Amendment protects the First, and that's true. Our founding fathers saw the right of individuals to keep and bear arms as the ultimate defense against tyranny. The genesis of this discussion is, once again, Oregon is a petri dish for the left. A gun confiscation bill was passed out of the Judiciary Committee and on to the full Senate, where it is likely to pass on Monday, May 1st, unless you do something about it. It is a petri dish bill because if it passes, other states will pass their own. It is a petri dish bill because it wants to introduce into the social psyche the notion that it is perfectly okay for the government to take guns away. It does so under the guise of a family member's concern, and technically, they're the ones taking the guns away, not the government. Senate Bill 719A allows a family or household member to go to the court and obtain an order to confiscate guns from an individual based entirely on their word and assessments that a family member may be under emotional duress and could be considered a danger to themselves or others now or in the foreseeable future. It also allows a law enforcement officer to deem you a threat. Yes, your local sheriff could determine you to be a threat and confiscate not just your guns, but any so-called deadly weapons. These orders may be issued without any allegations of actual criminal behavior. Wow. I'd like to welcome now David Keene. He is a former presidential advisor and former National Rifle Association president, but he is currently the opinion editor of the Washington Times, one of the few good things coming out of Washington, I might add. David, it's good to talk to you again.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
Yeah, you know, so we have had this bill that has made its way into committee. It's called SB 868, although it's now SB 719. And just reading to you a little bit from the bill here, this is just in the preamble. Says, quote, it creates a process for obtaining extreme risk protection order prohibiting person from possessing firearms when court finds that person presents imminent risk or risk in foreseeable future of suicide or causing injury to other persons, establishes procedures for peace officer or family or household member of person to apply for the order. Yeah, it's important to note also within this that it can be done ex parte, which means that you can get the order without the person even being in the courtroom to defend himself. I'm sure you're at least somewhat familiar with this bill and other ones that have been attempted like this. What do you make of this bill?
Well, it's the NRA's view, and I think it's a logical view given the fact that the United States Supreme Court has found that citizens have a fundamental right to own a firearm absent some prohibited class that they find themselves in or whatever. And our position, and I think the legally correct position, is that there are circumstances where you might want to have mental health professionals look at the stability of someone who might either be going to commit suicide or is inherently violent, but they should A, be professionals, and B, there should be due process. It is fundamentally wrong to deprive an American citizen of a fundamental right without due process of law. So the idea that a non-professional can go to a judge, go to a court, and say, we'd like to prevent this person from having a firearm on my say-so and without letting him know that we're doing it. That just, from a due process standpoint, is abhorrent to most American concepts of law. There's no requirement in this kind of a bill that the person that's targeted has ever done anything wrong.
No.
There's no need for the person seeking the order to allege that he's going to do anything wrong, he or she. And in consequence, it's both wrong and dangerous because of the slippery slope that you find yourself on with these kinds of laws. Now, let me give you an example of the other way in which the NRA, some years ago when the concealed carry law was instituted in Colorado, the NRA actually supported something that became known as the Naked Man Rule. And it was called that because hypothetically, the rule was that if the sheriff found somebody sitting naked on the courthouse lawn talking to Martians through a tinfoil hat and the guy wanted a permit, it might be reasonable to say, let's take a look at this guy first, even though at that point there had been no adjudication. It allowed the sheriff to say, we're not going to issue the permit to you, but within 24 or 48 hours, you have to go before a panel of professionals to see whether or not that's a reasonable act on our part. The difference between that and this is that allows people who have no professional expertise to, to deprive a citizen of a fundamental right with no due process of law, no notice, no allegation of wrongdoing, and without him having any chance of really confronting them, his accusers, or getting a court to really look at the substance of the charges being made against him. And that's wrong.
Yeah, it is absolutely wrong. You mentioned the due process part of things, and as I read the bill, that is certainly what I come away with as well, is that there's absolutely no due process. I have never liked ex parte types of rulings. It does allow people to come back in and challenge it within 30 days after they've been served, but even then, you have to go through a whole process, and as you say, it's simply based on accusations of somebody who isn't really qualified to make those kinds of determinations.
Well, that's exactly right. It doesn't go as far as a part of the laws that former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley tried to put through after Sandy Hook, in which anybody, a neighbor, an acquaintance, could go and accuse somebody of being aggressive or violent or a threat to the neighborhood or somebody he didn't like and get them to take away their firearms. It doesn't go that far. But it's on the road to going that far, and when you deprive any citizen of due process and a fundamental right without going through due process, you're really damaging the whole fabric of American democracy and freedom.
Yes, absolutely. That's a great place to take a break. Everyone say, well, that's going to be talking more about the Second Amendment and this crazy bill. Here in Oregon, it is Senate Bill 719A, and coming up, we'll be talking more about that bill along with its sponsor. And then later on at the end of the show, we'll be having some means that you can do something about it. And welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show, talking about Second Amendment today. We're talking with David Keene. He's a former presidential advisor and former National Rifle Association president. And he is currently the opinion editor of the Washington Times. And, David, whenever we talk about things about the Second Amendment and these kinds of discussions and all these different gun control bills that come out, it what always jumps to my mind is that little phrase, shall not be infringed. I mean, what part of the right to bear arms shall not be infringed do people not get?
Well, that's exactly right. The importance of those words in the Second Amendment and the Bill of Rights of the Constitution is that they are a recognition by the founders, by the authors of the Second Amendment, that the right to keep and bear arms is not something that would be granted to the people by the government they were created, but that they were a pre-existing right that government should not be allowed to infringe. The right to self-defense, the right to defend oneself, one's family, one's home, one's community, and one's nation is a right that has been recognized by philosophers for thousands and thousands of years.
Yes.
And what the Second Amendment of the American Constitution did was give explicit recognition of that right. Now, under Supreme Court rulings, any fundamental right is subject to what they call reasonable restrictions. But those restrictions have to be very, very carefully crafted. So if you're going to infringe upon somebody's right to bear arms or their right to speak freely, you better be careful. And the problem is that a lot of proposals sound like a good idea off the top of someone's head, and they're often introduced or proposed for the best of reasons.
Sure.
But they play havoc with the rights of Americans and with the underlying fundamental foundations of the American Republic.
Yeah. Well, best of intentions. Yeah, we'll definitely come back around to that. But that phrase, shall not be infringed, that's used nowhere else in the Constitution. Not even the word infringed is used anywhere else. And
That's exactly right. It's pretty explicit.
Yeah, and just as a nice little segue, I should mention the title of your book is Shall Not Be Infringed, The Assault on Your Second Amendment, released just last year, October 2016. And of course, we'll link that up on iSpyRadio.com. Just head to the store page. And
My wife says everyone should buy it.
That's right, they should. Anyway, we were talking about the best of intentions there, and Brian Boquist definitely tried to introduce this with the best of intentions. His stepson committed suicide, and that is apparently the main impetus for why he did this. But he also tried to get ahead of some of his critics on this. He says, this is from an Oregonian article, he says, Boquist tried to get ahead of arguments by the bill's opponents by addressing their biggest concern that it violates the Second Amendment. It doesn't, he assured the committee, because various courts have heard cases on the constitutionality of similar laws and ruled in their favor. So this notion of it doesn't violate the Constitution, pardon me if I don't believe the word of a state senator without him even citing any case law. Has there been a similar law been adjudicated or even heard by the Supreme Court?
No, there has not been. The Supreme Court has suggested in the Heller decision, which was incorporated under the McDonald case, Chicago versus McDonald, to the states, that a fundamental right can be subject to reasonable restrictions. In fact, it's the question of what's reasonable and is not reasonable that makes the makeup of the Supreme Court at this point so very, very important.
Yes.
Because before we know what the parameters of acceptable safeguards and restrictions are, we're going to have to get a dozen or two dozen cases to the Supreme Court. That's what they had to do with the First Amendment. And the parameters of what is and isn't allowed in terms of speech are fairly clear now, but they weren't clear in 1920. It took 50 to 100 cases going to the Supreme Court to ban taxes on speech and the like. And the same thing is going to have to happen with regard to the Second Amendment.
Yes.
One can sympathize and one should sympathize with what Senator Boquist is trying to do, but sometimes you want to accomplish something and you make a proposal that just, first of all, is wrong because it's not the way to go about it, and secondly, probably won't accomplish what you want to accomplish anyway.
Yeah,
and I think that's the case with this kind of a proposal.
Yeah, and I don't think he's really thought this through in terms of the ramifications of it either. I mean, he's under duress, obviously feeling the pain of loss, and I don't mean to undermine or devalue that pain in the slightest. But
exactly.
Really, why would anyone?
Man. He's always been a Second Amendment supporter.
He has been, yeah.
He's in circumstances where he's trying to deal with a tragedy.
Yeah,
and that's not always the best time to be drafting legislation, frankly.
No, it absolutely is not. And really, why would anyone need such a bill in the first place? I mean, if you think that a family member is under such duress that they might kill either themselves or someone else, why aren't you doing something about it on your own? Go to them and say, hey, you're under a lot of stress right now. I get that sense. I'm concerned about you. I'd like to why don't you let me hang on to your guns and other weapons just until you get through this? I mean, doing so, that would show concern to the person that you're there ready to reach out and maybe help them open up. Or if they do lash back at you, refusing to turn over any guns or weapons, that you would then, I mean, that would tell you that something needs to be done.
Well, and our institutions have not served such people very well either over the course of the last few decades. In the terms of veterans, the VA has not been doing what it should be doing. In terms of other citizens, we have basically dismantled our mental health care system. So we deal primarily, we spend a lot of money, but we deal primarily with people that are having a bad day rather than people that are in true crisis. So the real need is to reform those things, and the Congress has been trying to do that. Congressman Tim Murphy from Pennsylvania, for example, was tasked after the Sandy Hook killings. He's the only psychologist in the House, and he took a year to develop reforms of the mental health care system that might prevent some of these things.
Yeah.
Congress has dragged its feet, presidents have dragged their feet, but in one sense, this is a reaction to the frustration of the failure of institutions that are supposed to deal with these problems.
Right.
Their failure to deal with them.
Yeah.
And that's understandable, but it's not the way to solve the problem.
No, it certainly isn't. Okay, let's take a break there. Come back, we'll have more with David Keene, former president with the National Rifle Association. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're talking Second Amendment today on the iSpy Radio Show. I'm your host, Mark Anderson, talking today to David Keene, former presidential advisor and former National Rifle Association president, but he is currently the opinion editor of the Washington Times. His book out there just came out in October of 2016. It Shall Not Be Infringed, The Assault on Your Second Amendment. And we'll link all of that up on iSpyRadio.com. Just head to the store page where we'll not only have David's book, but also the books of all of our previous guests, all in one convenient spot. And in the last segment there, we were talking about doing laws for the good intentions. And of course, Brian himself is under some duress, obviously feeling the pain of loss of his stepson. But I'd like to explore this a little bit more. I mean, let's say that you have a situation where someone in your family or household is angry or depressed or upset about something. Maybe they're still feeling the pangs of being in the military and seeing some hard times. You go to court behind their back and get a court order, mind you, to take their guns, which means you've gone to court, put your hand on the Bible, and testified under oath that I believe my father, mother, brother, sister, son, or daughter is crazy, and they shouldn't be having guns. And then a policeman shows up on their door demanding their guns, and if they don't comply, they'll be arrested and hauled off to jail. Don't you think that in and of itself is going to cause a huge disruption in the family if that scenario plays out? I mean, what a breach of trust. Go behind their back like that, testify to complete strangers about a family member. I mean, if they're angry before, what do you think they'll be like after they hear that you've done all that?
That's exactly right. And also, there are families that are dysfunctional. And it gives family members and relatives a weapon to use against a family member that they don't like. And that's a problem as well. It's the reason we just don't let people have other people locked up, because they're mad at them. And that's really, they're mad about at them, or in this case, let's say legitimately concerned. Those are not reasons to lock people up, and they're not reasons to deprive people of their rights. The proper way to go about that is to contact a doctor, to contact the police, to really get somebody who's a professional to look into it to see if, in fact, there's a danger there. And that's done. And, part of the problem, as I said earlier, is that we have allowed the dismantling of our mental health system. If you look not to these instances, but to the mass shootings that have taken place over the last few years, in most cases, somebody has recognized that the eventual perpetrator needed help, and no one did anything about it. The most extreme case probably was the Washington Naval Yard shooter in Washington, D.C., who killed a number of people here. He was stopped by the Rhode Island State Police, who called the Navy and said, you need to do something about this guy because he's crazy. And the Navy ignored it. He came in, brought a shotgun to work, and the rest was history. So you obviously need to identify and then direct people to someplace where they can get treatment or where they can be adjudicated as potentially dangerous. But you can't allow a situation where anybody can just willy-nilly accuse somebody of things that they have no way to first of all, know whether are true.
Yeah. Well, it just seems ridiculous situation that Senator Boquist is putting us in this situation because of his own family's trauma. I mean, he's really projecting his trauma onto other family situations. And as horrible
and
as it
to
is,
to be fair, he's also being used.
Yes.
Because while I have all the sympathy, we all should, for Senator Boquist himself and for his family and for the tragedy he's undergone, look at some of the allies that he's jumped into bed with.
Yes.
These are folks who are simply part of the anti-Second Amendment lobby. They are looking for any way that they can to deny anyone under any circumstances the ability to acquire or use a firearm for legal purposes. And this is just one of the things that they support. They support just about anything else that a gun owner, a supporter of the Second Amendment, is opposed to. And they're, in that sense, they're exploiting his tragedy to get him to support their agenda.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. As horrible as it is to lose a child through a horrific incident like that, using his own logic to push this bill that he might be under mental duress, it kind of makes you wonder, shouldn't he be blocked from voting for his own bill?
Well, I've said that a congressman or a representative with a vote is more dangerous with than a citizen with a gun anyway. And maybe they should have a 3-day waiting period or something.
But
in all seriousness, he or his colleagues need to recognize that as sympathetic as they should be to him, that his judgment is
somewhat impaired,
in this issue is necessarily clouded. And he ought to step back, and his colleagues ought to ask him to step back and think about the consequences of the kind of proposal he's made on the one hand, and think about the allies that he's jumping in bed with on the other.
Yes, absolutely. And of course, I'm being facetious, but it's unfortunate that naked man rule doesn't apply to legislators as well.
I know some that I think might be talking to Martians with tinfoil hats.
Yes, they're hearing voices for sure. So President Trump recently, in the past week, removed an Obama-appointed Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy. Murthy says that he was removed because he was advocating that gun violence is a public health issue, and I'm sure that he would also argue that it is a mental health issue as well. He feels that any death from gun violence is preventable, and you know, that seems rather simplistic, I think. I mean, you could say every death from a car wreck is preventable.
Yeah, one of the reasons that this fight goes on and on is it's the anti-gun lobby, if you will, is in some part almost a quasi-religious drive. There are actual people out there who believe that if you could snap your fingers and eliminate firearms, there would be no more robberies, there would be no more burglaries, there'd be no violent crime, there'd be no suicides. And in trying to reduce these things, they don't go after criminals. They don't deal with mental health issues. They say if we just got rid of the guns, everything would be fine.
Yeah.
You know, there have been studies in this country and abroad, and while there are some minor mixed evidence, the strong evidence is that if you eliminate guns, that doesn't do much to, reduce the suicide rate. In other countries, that don't have firearms ownership, the prime method of suicide is hanging. That's number two here. So what you have to deal with is the person in crisis's desire to take his or her life. And that's something that a lot of people don't want to deal with. They just think they can snap their fingers and they can create a utopia by removing firearms. John Bolton, our former UN ambassador, did the foreword to our book, and he said it's a little bit like the unilateral disarmament crowd in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, people who actually believed that if the United States destroyed its weapons, we would enter into
everybody else would too.
International utopia where everybody else would do it because they no longer have a threat.
Yeah, well, it's kind of funny how the Greeks
didn't do that.
Well, it's kind of funny how Greeks were killing Persians long before gunpowder was ever invented. So, all right, let's take a break there. Coming up, talking some more with David Keene, former president of the NRA, and also currently the opinion editor for Washington Times, talking about guns and mental health. Stay with us. And welcome back. This is the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking about Second Amendment and mental health, thanks to a bill that was pushed out of committee here in Oregon, SB 719. It likely to pass here, thanks to a Democrat majority, plus Brian Boquist, a Republican, who was the sponsor of the bill. Talking about David Keene, he is the opinion editor of the Washington Times and former presidential advisor, as well as former National Rifle Association president, and his book is Shall Not Be Infringed, The Assaults on Your Second Amendment, and just find that on iSpyRadio.com. Head to the store page. In the time that we have left with you here in this segment, some of these mental health issues, they are troubling, especially considering the fact that there was some efforts within Obamacare to try to start using mental health as a means by which to strip away guns. Certainly Clinton kind of started all that with the ball rolling with the VA and having to share information with the FBI and some of these other organizations. I mean, do you have any idea right now where that whole mental health portion of the Obamacare law stands today?
Well, there's still, until it's all repealed, there are still dangers involved in it. Of course, the during the Clinton administration, they came up with this theory that firearms were and that firearms deaths were all mental health problems, that it was a national health problem. and they began to use the government to promote that position. The Congress eventually said you cannot propagandize using funds that are there for research and for health care. There's been an effort, as you know, to get doctors to ask and report whether or not their patients own or possess firearms in their homes, ostensibly to protect the children. Now, the fact is that accidental shootings, accidents involving children and firearms are rarer today than they were in 1916, in spite of the fact that we have a much bigger country and millions of more firearms. It's the Centers for Disease Control at one point a couple of years ago suggested that your child was more likely to drown in a bucket of water while you were cleaning your kitchen than he was to be injured in a firearms accident. So in large measure, a lot of these things are just are mythological kinds of dangers. Doesn't mean it doesn't happen, but it means these are very, very, very rare incidents.
Yeah.
But this kind of what we really have is an attempt to find any kind of group that you can deny firearms use or ownership to. For example, during the Clinton years, the Clinton administration decided to put on the prohibited list any veteran who'd asked for counseling. And the Congress had to come back because that infected 69,000 people with no finding of anything. Congress went back and said, no, you can't do that. This time around, the Obama administration, by executive order, tried to say that anyone who had help with their finances, a veteran, would be denied firearms rights, even though they could show no empirical connection between that and dangerousness. And in fact, the entire mental health community, along with the ACLU and the NRA, got Congress to reverse that because it was an outrageous attempt just to find groups of people that you could deny firearms to. The Brady people, Bloomberg people, have suggested that anybody that gets picked up for a DWI should be denied their firearms rights for 5 or 10 years.
Yes.
On the grounds that drunks are dangerous people. And I asked at one of these things, I asked one of the people from the Bloomberg group if they had any empirical evidence that if you drank one beer too many, you were going to shoot up a mall. And where is the evidence of dangerousness? They said, well, you know, that's really not the point. It isn't. Their point is they want to deny guns to as many people as they can.
That's right.
And to demonize gun ownership to the extent that they can get away with doing so.
That's right. And I believe in this bill, DUI was one of the criteria that they could use to strip your guns from you.
Right. Now, the fact that a criminal drinks doesn't mean that everybody who drinks is a criminal.
You know? Yeah, exactly right.
Because somebody gets drunk, somebody who's prone to get into fights drinks, doesn't mean that everybody who drinks is prone to get into fights. I mean, in this country, we tend, first of all, to overreact to things. And secondly, we've always been trying to find some way to identify wrongdoers before they do wrong.
Yes.
Yeah. Remember, at one point it was black people commit crimes, right? Or poor people commit crimes. In the 70s, they had the criminal chromosome. Unfortunately for them, there was physical characteristics, freckles and red hair. So at the time, I said, well, there go the Irish. They're more prone to commit crimes. And now it's people who have a drink, people who drive after having had a drink. There are all kinds of reasons.
Yes.
But they're all designed to see if there isn't a way to deny yet another group a right guaranteed in the Constitution. And when they try to do that, that should be opposed.
Yeah.
In this country, we deal not with groups, we deal with individuals.
That's right. Should be,
and
anyway.
We
yes.
Provide individuals with due process. And if you're going to deprive somebody of that right, you have, it seems to me, an obligation, legal and moral, to demonstrate that that individual is dangerous.
Yeah.
And if you can't do that, you shouldn't be messing with his constitutional rights.
No, absolutely not. Just real quick, we've got about a minute here with you. There are over 114 federal judgeships that Trump will be nominating. Do you have any idea that Second Amendment support is one of the criteria that he's using?
Well, I don't. You know, his promise during the campaign to nominate someone to fill the Scalia seat on the Supreme Court with someone who thinks like Scalia was made only for that seat. But earlier this week, and the really the important seat on the Supreme Court is the next one,
yes,
which is liable to come this summer when a lot of people think that Justice Kennedy is going to retire. That's the key to the future of the Supreme Court. And the list of people, the informal list of people that are being named, leads one to believe that the president is thinking in terms of somebody like Gorsuch, like Scalia for that seat. And that's going to be important there.
Yeah, well, then it would make sense then that the other 114 judgeships out there is going to have that same kind of criteria.
And so he's relying heavily. On advice from, for example, the Federalist Society and other groups in vetting judges for these other appointments. And if that's the case, and I believe it is the case, and if the kinds of people he's thought about for the Supreme Court are going to be followed by the same kind of people at the Court of Appeals level and the district court level, then he has an opportunity to truly protect the Constitution.
Yeah, we should be okay at that
public
point.
For decades into the future.
Yeah, yeah. Well, David, I want to think
if he does that, then that's a presidency that deserves applause.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, David, I want to thank you so much for your time today.
Anytime. It was a pleasure.
All right, his book one more time is Shall Not Be Infringed, The Assaults on Your Second Amendment. David, thank you again.
My pleasure.
Welcome back to the iSpy Radio Show. We're talking Second Amendment today. Just got done talking with David Keene. He is the opinion editor for the Washington Times and a former president of the NRA. I'd like to welcome now Jane Carroll. Jane has her own show on KUIK 1360 AM in Portland, one of the stations we air on. Jane is the voice of calm reason and common sense up there. Although, Jane, being in Portland, you're kind of like John the Baptist, I imagine, a voice crying in the wilderness, aren't you?
It's a lonely job. Somebody has to do it.
Yes, it sure is. Yeah, how you doing today?
I'm doing okay. How about you?
Good. I'm doing real well. So we wanted to have you on because we're talking gun control and the effort to take away guns, and there is a specific case in Portland that seems to embody a lot of what is happening with the effort by the left to destroy gun rights. And I'm talking about the case of Mike Strickland. He was arrested last year after a BLM protest. He drew his gun on some protesters because he was feeling threatened. Walk us through what happened that morning for those listeners who have not seen the video, which we will post up on iSpyRadio.com.
All right. It is important you go see the video and watch it because, real quickly, background on Mike Strickland. Mike Strickland is a citizen journalist. He has a website called Laughing at Liberals. He has done all kinds of important exposés. Citizen journalists do a job that mainstream media refuses to do, and they cover stories about the left that basically are not covered in most outlets, and so they are much loathed by the establishment politics in the state of politicians in the state of Oregon. And Mike has been a strong champion of the Second Amendment. He's also been physically assaulted on several occasions because of his coverage by anarchists, thugs, Black Lives Matter. A lot of that's a redundancy, but he is. So as a result of that, he became legal concealed weapon carrier. And last July, he was filming a Black Lives Matter protest. I think it was precisely the same day that those police officers were murdered in Dallas. And Mike was carrying, he had his weapon with him, and he had quite a bit of ammunition, which was used against him. Well, Mike was carrying, and he was approached by five men dressed in black with masks. They were moving in on him as he was doing his. He told them back off. They didn't, and he pulled his gun. And he pointed it at them and people started to scream, and some people were around in the protest that obviously didn't know what was going on, and somebody carrying a gun. He never put his finger on the trigger. He did hold it forth. The men started retreating. Then suddenly, and this is all very quickly, he sensed through his peripheral vision that somebody was coming at him from his side. He took the gun and waved it across, just to turn. He just turned, and the gun went with him, never on the trigger. Eventually, things calmed down. He backed off. He put his gun away. He went in and actually turned himself over to the police, I think, for protection.
Hmm.
They booked him, pot him down in Multnomah County. The police were very sort of sympathetic. Yeah, these guys, you got to be careful. And Mike was booked. He was basically told that he'd be getting out and charged with misdemeanors. His bail would be set by a night court. A friend of his, a fellow citizen journalist, went down to bail him out. By the time he was before the court, these misdemeanors had been escalated to 21 felony counts. 9 of them were for that second where he took his gun and turned. That was 9 counts. Each one of those has a minimum of 3 years in prison if you're found guilty. And his bail had been raised to $250,000. He had had a political target put on him. Some of the Second Amendment right folks gathered around. It took about 12 days to get somebody to put up bail for him. And then he was put into a Multnomah County court where he was faced with a jury trial or a trial by judge. They opted for a jury trial. There was a jury pool of 40 people. They looked at the questionnaires. 38 of the 40 had said they didn't even think people should be allowed to own guns in Multnomah County. So the jury pool was very tainted. And there were several people who had actually been at the protest at the Black Lives Matter. So they said, we better go with a judge, because they thought they had a real strong case of self-defense. Of course, the case was, I attended the bulk of the trial. It was very strong for the defense, very weak. The prosecutors were very weak. They obviously didn't put in the A-team. The judge, after listening to the closing arguments on Friday afternoon, late Friday afternoon, 4 or 5 hours of closing arguments, in about 90 seconds ruled that Mike was guilty on all 21 counts.
Wow.
And would be sentenced on May 3rd.
Wow. Wow. Well, you know, actually, let's take a break there. We've got kind of a big question for you coming up, and then it'll leave us a little bit more time for us. We'll continue the story of Mike Strickland with Jane Carroll. Stay with us. Welcome back. We're in our final segment now, talking about the Second Amendment and gun rights, and we're talking with Jane Carroll. She is the host of the Jane Carroll Show up in Portland. That's on KUIK 1360 AM if you're up there driving around, or anywhere via KUIK.com. So Jane, we're talking about this case of Mike Strickland, and before we get back to the judiciary side of things, there was just one thing that I wanted to bring up from the video that maybe you could enlighten us on. There's a reverse angle that shows him from across the street, and when he draws his gun, he's already backed up at that point, and there doesn't appear to be anybody within 10 to 15 feet of him. Do you have any idea why he chose to draw his gun at that point?
I don't. And I think that if you look at some of the videos from the other angles, that they're actually – that angle did not capture what was approaching here. He's obviously – very frightened, and he'd been beaten up before. He had his arm broken in 4 different places, spent some time in the hospital. He'd been pushed down a flight of stairs. He did not, and everybody agrees with this, he did not use the best logic in how he used his gun, and there probably were some misdemeanor offenses affiliated with this, but nobody was hurt.
No.
And
there's no shots fired. We should make that clear.
No shots fired. He never put his finger on the trigger.
Yeah, well, I know that there was a couple of people standing there that had masks on. That would certainly be intimidating, and that's where it gets hard to judge this, because you're not in his head. You can't even make out the words that are being said on the video in terms of right before he decided to draw his gun. And, you know, if he'd been assaulted in the past, as you say, then, you know, you kind of have to give him the benefit of the doubt. So let's get back to this judge. It's astonishing that they found him guilty on all of these counts. And the potential for punishment here, to me, is not even close to fitting what ought to be happening for this, where, you know, yeah, okay, he drew a gun probably perhaps unnecessarily. But 20 counts now against him? I mean, that's
21
absurd.
21 counts. Guilty on all 21 counts.
That's absurd.
It really is. He's 36 years old. He's going to spend the rest of his life behind bars. And it's more to do with the fact that he's a citizen journalist that has championed Second Amendment rights. And so he's a twofer. This guy has a target on him. He's a very nice young man. It's a tragedy of astronomic proportions, and it was the kangaroo court.
Well, what bothers me, too, is that he is the one, the only one being punished at this point. What about the people in the mask? What about the people that were up in his face? Why aren't they facing charges of, menacing?
Well, because I guess they couldn't identify them, but or they're saying that...
Well, there's several that don't, that didn't have masks on, though.
I know, but they don't care about that. For example, when Mike was beaten up, when his arm was broken in four places and he had to have surgery, and the doctor said it was the worst broken arm he'd ever seen in his life, they stole his camera equipment. Mike knew who it was, knew where he lived. They caught him with his camera equipment, and the DA wouldn't prosecute him.
Wow. Wow. Well, so, of course, this is Portland, and so you don't expect much out of Portland, but...
No, you don't.
Aside from that, guns are intended for self-defense. Even people on the left will say, well, you know, I can understand why people would want a gun for self-defense. If the government, as embodied by this judge, says you, that you can't use a gun for self-defense, then what's the point? I mean, are they just supposed to let people beat us up?
Yeah. I guess so, because evidently when the person that beat him up and stole his equipment, which was valuable equipment, and they found him and they got him with it, and they never pressed charges. They never had a court case.
Couldn't Mike have then sued for damages?
Well, his legal advice was without the government saying there was any there, he did get back his equipment, and it was he said there wasn't a case.
Well, you know, you've lived in Portland area for a long time. I mean, when you see this kind of case, how does this make you feel? I mean, do you feel safer for this? I mean, I can't imagine that you would, but I mean, do you feel like the whole town is just going to hell in a handbasket here?
Yeah, and it really seems to be escalating. For example, Portland was the scene of the most major riots, the biggest temper tantrums by the left after President Trump was elected. They destroyed $1 million worth of damage. None of them were prosecuted.
I mean, the absurdity of this is just beyond measure. I mean, this is like somebody breaking into your house, and you're the one that gets arrested for having a house full of all this stuff that people would want.
Or for having a gun and maybe not using follow every little rule book. I want to make clear that, because there's a lot of gun rights people that were sort of angry with Mike for not using some of the procedures that you're supposed to use that are common sense. But the guy was scared, and there's got to be some human factor into all of this. And okay, he gets charged with community service or something. This man is going to be behind bars the rest of his life.
Yeah, for just pulling a gun to protect himself, and that's
right.
What he's facing.
Right. The judge said he did not do it in self-defense. If he did not do it in self-defense, they're acting like he went there as a racist to go kill some people. That was his intent.
Well, and that was the other absurd thing. We only got about 30 seconds here with you, but the other absurd thing was the BLM at that rally were saying, take out your guns and shoot people.
Yep. And five and police officers had been mowed down in Dallas at the same time. This he was targeted. There was reports that there was some of them were saying we're going to go get us some Mike Strickland. They did threaten, they did intimidate, they did scare him, and he acted in self defense. But the judge didn't even consider that. It was just a kangaroo court.
Yeah, it sure sounds it. Well, Jane, I want to thank you so much for your time. Again, their website is KUIK.com if you'd like to visit. Listen to her during the afternoon. She's on from 3 to 6, correct?
Yes, Monday through Friday. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane.
Any help anybody can give on this case, he's going to be sentenced on May 3rd. Our best hope is for an appeal, but that who knows, in Multnomah County, justice is not served.
No, that's for sure. This is the state we live in, literally, but it's coming for the rest of you. A reminder to call your senators to tell them to vote no on Senate Bill 719A. I know it's the weekend. Leave a message. SB 719A, tell them no. Even better, head to iSpyRadio.com, and on this week's show page, we'll have a link where you can email your senator. It'll take you to the NRA's Legislative Action page. Look for a big red button. Click here. Take action. Can't miss it. You fill out a form so they know which senator belongs to you, and then they have a simple email with a form letter already set for you to use, or write your own, which is what I did. Hope you enjoyed today's show. Keep Mike in your prayers and take action on that bill, because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.